Just a note before we start. Our show talks about touchy subjects that may be difficult for some of our listeners. Take care of yourself. If you feel you need to seek help, see the links at the end of our show notes for resources.
Hey y'all, and welcome to Touchy Subjects Podcast, a podcast that aims to break the silence that tends to come with conversations around domestic and sexual violence. I'm Sean.
And I'm Amanda.
And today we're going to be discussing narcissism in the workplace with our special guest, Lindsay Ruiz. So thank you for joining us today, Lindsay.
Very excited to be here and have this really important conversation. And hopefully your audience will take a few tips away that can be helpful for them too.
Yes, we're super excited for it, especially based on when we met the first time, that just hearing you talk, knowing that this conversation was going to be a really fun one, especially for our listeners. So thank you for joining us. So really quickly, Lindsay, do you want to introduce yourself to our audience?
Absolutely. The first thing I'm going to say, because your audience is going to get an accent from me, and I'll try to slow down as I speak, but I'm Venezuelan. I was born and raised in South America, came to the United States 22 years ago. My professional career has evolved from advertising and marketing into operations in the healthcare sector. And lately, I want to say 14 years or so, working in large scale transformation programs for big companies. Basically orchestrating the implementation of either new technologies or new operating models or new big workspace holistic type strategies. And the combination of, you know, my years in the workplace have really been one of the puzzle pieces that got me interested in studying and researching and getting acquainted with different dysfunctions in the workplace, to be able to have informed conversations and put tools and practices out there that can help make our organizations a little bit healthier than they sometimes happen to be.
As I'm sure many of our listeners are aware, sometimes our workplaces aren't like the super healthiest for us to be. And even if we like our job, if our workplace isn't one that we enjoy being at, it makes it very difficult to want to be there. So,
and a big mention to, if it's not fun for everyone to be at, because you might be part of like a great little clique at your workplace that you just feel like, oh, well, we just have a great time and whatever, it's fine. If not everybody is joining in on that fun, some people may be, you know, being more quiet about it, but they might be being offended by things that you're saying. They might feel excluded. They might feel picked on. They might feel like they're being targeted for certain things because they're not a part of that little inner circle. So there's a lot of that that goes on, too, that not everybody necessarily recognizes.
Absolutely.
So, Lindsay, what really led you to want to really have conversations about narcissism in the workplace and make this be one of your focal points?
It started in my professional, in my personal life. Some years ago, we're not going to talk about age in this conversation, but some years ago, I had a personal crossroads in my life that led me to investigate behaviors that I was the recipient of and I did not understand. And my own personal curiosity and research to try to understand my circumstances put me in front of what is known as narcissistic abuse. Many years later, I also recognized that this type of dynamic happens at home as the same way it happens in the workplace. I started sort of connecting some dots between my personal experience and my experience as an employee, as a leader, as a practitioner of orchestrating transformations and getting to hear more and more and more experiences from other people. being affected by similar circumstances. And when I decided to embark on my doctoral degree, my academic journey at the doctoral level, I wanted to do something meaningful with my dissertation. And since this has been a recurring theme in my life, in every corner and walk that I've been passing through, my dissertation pretty much was ideal to document some of the learnings and some of the information that's already out there that a lot of people don't have access to until the last minute when they start doing their own research because of the same thing, right? They're going through things, they don't know what it is. They go to Google, and then that's when you start learning what the situations are. And I use my dissertation to investigate narcissistic abuse in the workplace, use more re-owned methodologies to research it and put names to things and be able to validate that the dynamic actually take place in the organizations as well. And what happens when people go through it, and how do we propagate them, and what keeps them happening, and why can we get rid of them? And it was the conclusion of my learning journey altogether. And now I feel like I have some information that may be helpful for other people. So I'm just excited to share it, and hopefully it'll spark something on others who may be going through the same thing and not know it yet.
So I really like how you made those connections between what you experienced in your personal life and then being able to see that happen in your professional life as well. I'm sure that almost every single person who is listening to our podcast has had to deal with somebody who has narcissistic tendencies, whether that's in their personal life or in their professional life at some point. And sometimes if we can notice it in one place, it will help us to notice it better in the other place, because you, like you said, you can catch those patterns, you can catch those things that happen. So while we might not think of it like, oh, it's work and that's just my boss and that's just how things go, we can actually start to recognize those patterns and put a name to it and say, hey, no, this isn't just the way it needs to be because I'm at work.
But I appreciate making that that connection too, because I say it all the time at presentations that abusive people aren't like super creative, because they don't have to be, because all abusive people know what works in order to get power over someone else or to exert their dominance or to show the other people that, yeah, I'm more important than you are in this situation. So it's really nice to know that that connection is there for our listeners, because maybe they say like, yeah, my relationship is super great, but what I'm experiencing at work doesn't feel kind of right, and they can still make those connections and stuff. So
I want to comment on both of you. Yeah. Point of view. To Amanda's point, precisely because it happens in the workplace as well, it was important for me to shed some lights to it. You know, when you come from an abusive upbringing, right, you don't choose your family, you don't choose sometimes you walk into personal relationships because you're, you know, unconscious of those patterns, and you repeat them, and you get to, you know, perpetuate certain patterns of relationships until one day you figure out, oh my gosh, this is not going in the right direction, and there's something I have to do differently. However, you do choose your workplaces. You do have certain level of autonomy as to, you know, what kind of leader you want to be, what kind of leader you want to follow, what kind of work environment empowers you, or, you know, or disempower you. And the fact that those type of personalities play a role in our careers and in our livelihood in the workplace, it is even more important for me that we have some language and some recognition that, to your point, Sean, right, these are playbooks, they're predictable. And once you're able to intellectualize it and be able to detach from the emotion and the the abuse itself and you start to understand it from the outside and connecting some dots, I feel like we can get ahead of it. And I feel like we can be more equipped to either deal with it or avoid it or become an advocate for it. But we have some level of autonomy when it comes to the workplace, in which the awareness of it is even more powerful.
So when discussing the awareness then of it, because like we've talked about, there is kind of like a playbook that they're using. What are some things that people could look for in their workplace if they don't quite feel like their workplace is like the super healthiest place?
So let's break it down into probably three components. Okay. The first component is the individual. That I typically don't like to put so much attention to it because there's a lot being written about narcissistic leaders. And, you know, typically those conversations don't necessarily make the impact that we want them to make. But I think it's important that people realize that those individuals, the same way they exist at home, their personalities don't go away because they now enter the workplace. And so it's important that we realize that there are people out there, that they're not a small minority, as some people might argue, right? That they fall on a spectrum of a psychological pathology. Some people are, you know, and there are narcissistic traits that we all carry naturally that are healthy, that are driven. But it is the spectrum of how people show up in the workplace and those traits become acute and they play out in how they use people as a means to an end. And I think that is the line that we need to be aware of when we're dealing with people, basically, right? We know what we see from people. We don't know people's intentions until they start demonstrating them. And we need to be a little bit more in tune in understanding where emotions may come, where motives may come from, what kind of behaviors may seem normalized. However, those are behaviors that hurt other people, or when we see individuals that pretty much are out there for themselves and do whatever it takes to move them up into positions of power and control and visibility, right? And so the individual conversation is important. It's important to understand that there is such a thing as narcissistic personality disorder, which is the most extreme pathology out there, that is part of a very well, you know, studied and researched field of psychology, that there are metrics that people with this type of disorder get measured against to determine whether or not they have the disorder and whether or not they need treatment. And these people not always seek treatment, nor do they seek building the awareness necessary to get better. And so we are dealing with those individuals in plain sight. And sometimes it is too late when it comes for us to realize that we may have been influenced or impacted by a manager, a coworker, a leader that, you know, hides that type of personality. If we were to kind of see red flags, right, that may give us some indication that we may or not be dealing with somebody that is on the unhealthy side of these type of behaviors, we may be looking at somebody that, you know, lacks self-awareness. Basically, they don't necessarily see their flaws, and they don't necessarily see that they have any accountability for wrongdoing, and pretty much see themselves through the lens of superiority and ultra deserving. And, you know, they lack the ethics of respecting other people's ideas, but instead, you know, feel entitled to other people's ideas and contributions as their own to, you know, elevate themselves in the organization or in front of superiors. Or to advance their careers. They may show, you know, themselves as having achievements and talents that are bigger than what the rest of us might recognize they are. They might be, you know, overly exaggerating those achievements, They may be people who like to monopolize conversations, who would want to impatiently try to drive, you know, a piece of decision or agenda or something, you know, without considering the impact on the rest of the individuals or the ecosystem affected by it. And these are also people who are very charismatic. You know, there are, it depends on who perspective you take, right? Some literature might suggest that these are aggressive people and people who are out there to get you, but not necessarily. These are people who are really great chameleons of social norms and show up with a lot of charismatic behaviors and complementary type of, you know, involvement that is sometimes even super exaggerated, that feels awkward. And those are little signals that you may be dealing with somebody that is either a complete, you know, narcissist or maybe in the spectrum of showing someone healthy behaviors that we want to be careful with. So I'll take a pause there. There are a couple other components I want to dive deeper into, but I want to know if there's anything from here you want me to expand on.
Yeah. So I actually really enjoyed the distinction made between people exhibiting narcissistic traits and those with narcissistic personality disorder, because it can be really easy for us to pass off somebody who's exhibiting narcissistic traits as somebody who might just, oh, it's just who they are because that's the disorder that they have. So we'll write that off for them. When in reality, many of us will exhibit some narcissistic traits because we like to think we're good at things. Like, we want to be the ones who are like, oh yeah, my idea was super great and that's the idea we ran with, so yeah, I'm awesome.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a difference between exhibiting some of those traits that are going to help make you be driven towards wanting to do better or do more at work versus the minority of people who actually have the personality disorder. So I appreciate that distinction there.
Absolutely. I mean, there is definitely, we need to, I don't want to go too much deep into like the pathology, the psychology, because I'm not a doctor. I'm not a psychiatrist myself. I just know enough to be dangerous when it comes to that side of the conversation. But I mean, we need to understand that it's part of our development as humans, right? Like every toddler, every teenager, like when we are in that developmental stage, we are narcissists. It's everything about ourselves and our needs and what we want and our attachment to our parents, and the world pretty much revolves around us. The problem is that some of us grow out of that stage, and you know, we may keep certain traits that help us become successful and driven, and you know, help us deal with, you know, fear of rejection and fear of public speaking, and we overcome that and we're out there and we find comfort into putting ourselves, you know, out there in our ideas, in our ambitions, which is healthy, right, the majority of the time. But some people get stuck in their developmental stage into adulthood where it becomes a maladaptive behavior and they never grow into functional adults that have the ability to empathize with other people, that have the ability to recognize their flaws, that have the ability to work through their flaws to become better and better and better human beings, right, in the long run, that are able to understand the limits of my wants versus the rights of other people, right, and they just walk all over it. So that impulsiveness and that they see other humans as objects that they can use for their own personal benefit is the danger of the immaturity behavior that some adults continue to have.
Right. It's kind of one of those things where, like, you'll hear someone be like, man, I just wonder, like, am I a bad person? Like, I do these things and know that, like, people who are actually bad people aren't questioning that about themselves. So that kind of falls into this too. Like, if you're questioning, I'm feeling like maybe I'm being a little narcissistic, like, is that something I should be concerned about? Then you might just have like one or two of those tendencies But real narcissistic people aren't trying to keep that in check. So if you're recognizing it in yourself and you're doing something to try and correct that behavior, to try and be more empathetic toward other people, then that's okay. It's when you just don't even consider those things that we generally have people with some problems.
Well, you don't even think there's something wrong with you.
Right, exactly. That they're not asking themselves, like, is there something wrong with me? No, of course there's nothing wrong with me. Why would there be? I'm perfect.
Totally.
And it's fun to think about, too, because there's definitely situations where you would want somebody with some of those traits to be in positions, right? It's like everyone has certain traits about them that works well for specific situations. I'm a very outgoing person. I am better out in the community. Do not put me behind a desk. I'm useless there. It's like everyone has traits that will work well for them. Like I can easily think of, like, if I was a coach for a sports team, like I want a bunch of players who are narcissistic and believe they're really good and want to prove to other people that they're really good. I don't want a narcissistic person who is then unwilling to practice because they believe they're so good they don't need to. So it's like you want some of those traits because they can be beneficial, but you don't want to take them too far.
Mm-hmm. And that's a hard line to throw at people sometimes too. Like, you know, we want you to be bold, but not too bold. We want you to be, you know, ambitious, but not too ambitious. Like it's a hard line to toe when you're talking about what I do impacts everyone else around me at work. But as long as you're cognizant of the fact that your actions impact other people and you don't want those actions to impact other people negatively, then you're probably in safe grounds with what you're doing or thinking.
Yeah. And I think this is going in the direction of the next component that we need to understand, right? Because at the end of the day, if you're dealing with a narcissistic person, a real, true, abusive leader, manager, coworker, somebody who's really trying to exert control and fear onto you in order for them to gain territory, or simply because they see you as a threat or as a competition, right? There is a systemic view as to how those people made it to where they are. Why are they allowed to have that behavior and go unchecked? And what can we do as an individual on the recipient side to be aware and deal with those circumstances? Because when you are, and when I talk about abuse, I think it's important to define that too, because, you know, and you know this very well from a domestic violence point of view, right? When you have a victim of DV, it's not until the bruise shows in the face that that person is believed or that person can come forward with evidence, quote unquote. Yep. But in narcissistic abuse, the bruise is invisible. The bruise is emotional, psychological, sometimes physical, in that, you know, it affects your it gives you real physical symptoms, you know, it gives you migraines, it turns into some kind of, you know, equivalent symptoms of PTSD in certain cases, right? And we need to do, as individuals, make sure that we are able to recognize when we are in an abusive situation, even if we don't have a physical bruise on our face, right? These people utilize triangulation. They beat people against each other when we're a part of a team. They use belittling, backhanded, you know, comments that you may sit somewhat in a situation where you knew you were offended and you knew you were, you know, a boundary was crossed in your essential humanity, but it was done in such a subtle way that you can't really point out what was it that he meant to say or she meant to say. It could be, tactics like stonewalling. Maybe somebody that you're trying to have an adult conversation to resolve a problem, that person is pretty much giving you the ice rule to not validate your feelings or to gaslight you into thinking that, you know, what you're bringing across from your experience is crazy, is not, is sensitive, is too, you know, unimportant. And so they bring along very sophisticated tactics that are sometimes invisible. And they create these dynamics where, you know, some people call it dog whistling, right? That only you and that person know is happening, but the rest of the environment does not pick up on it. Yeah. And that is a really, really, really dangerous and unhealthy place to be by the time you recognize you're dealing with somebody with such a profound and pervasive, you know, disorder that it's applying tactics of abuse onto you, even if it is in the workplace and even if you don't understand why this person is doing it. That is their defense mechanism. That is the way their brain works. And that's how they know how to survive in the world when they identify a threat. And sometimes that threat might be you, and you may be wondering, why me? If I'm a good person, I just want to do my work, I just want to be, you know, the best, you know, employee I can be. And sometimes that in itself presents a threat for these individuals, because it threatens their competence, and it puts them at risk of being exposed as, you know, fraud and, you know, people that don't have the talents that they argue they have. So as individuals in the dynamic, it's important that we're able to look beyond. There is this thing that I like from a former professor, that he says we have to always educate ourselves to look at the space between the leaves in a tree. Not just focus on the leaves, don't focus on the branches, focus on the space in between, to be able to expand our awareness, our ability to read the room, and our ability to see behaviors and red flags that otherwise could not be catched by the normal eye, you know, and awareness that we typically have.
Yeah. And I liked it there. So two things. The one I really like is, like, so talking about the dog whistling, for example, it's one of those behaviors that we'll talk about a lot when it comes to talking about domestic violence. But the example that I give is one that a lot of people can relate to. And it's like, how many of you, when you were a kid, like, did something and your mom gave you that look and you knew you had to stop doing what you were doing? It's like, we recognize, like, that look. That's the look that she has given you multiple times, so you know what follows the look. But that's knowledge between the two of you, because that look's going to look different for your mom, Lindsay, and versus my mom. We understand that messaging. That's that dog whistling. That's that, I'm going to give you this or send you this or do something, and you know what I mean, but you're the only person in this room that knows what I mean right now.
And you know there's a consequence you're about to suffer too.
Yes. 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 And then also looking at that questioning on, like, how do these people get into these positions, or how did they even get here? And I'm sure this might be the next step, Lindsay, so I could be jumping. But when we're thinking about how narcissistic traits can show up and what it looks like to an employer, they're seeing somebody who is very ambitious. They are seeing somebody who has very good work ethic, who gets results, who gets things done. So from the standpoint of an employer, if I want my managers and those in positions of power to be the best employees that I have, if I am seeing somebody who is exhibiting those narcissistic traits show up as someone who is a good employee, then that can be how we push them into those managerial and leadership roles, which then starts to create that problem for those underneath them, because now it's somebody who is narcissistic who has power over them.
And when you're going to say something, Amanda?
I was just, so if you're interviewing for something, you know, you're only bringing your side of the story to the table. You're going to bring in how, oh, I had this idea and we went with this idea and it gave us this much of a return on the investment. And, you know, those are great things. Or, If you're talking about within someone that's already like in the workplace, like you said, they're very charismatic people. They might already kind of have the eye or have the ear of someone higher up, and they can be saying those things, saying like, well, when I do this, this, and this, these are the results that we get. And they're only hearing that part of the conversation. So they don't know that who else did you step on to get to that spot? Who else's idea did you take to get to that? So it's really common because a narcissistic person is out for themselves. They want everyone to think that they're doing the greatest job of the greatest thing. And so that's the image they're going to put forward.
And they're also, part of their manipulation strategies are to isolate people. They build these triangles where they are in the center controlling everything. They control the narrative, you know, of words, and they control whatever is happening that is feeding them what they need to show in the way that they want to show to gain admiration and seldom, right? The people who are on the top levels challenge that, because likely we have more of those at the higher ranks, and it works for everybody. But I also think there is a lot of ignorance around how pervasive and damaging these type of behaviors really are, you know, for other humans, let alone for the organization, for the, you know, for the goals of, you know, the strategy or all the execution parts of it that it also affects. But there's not a serious conversation around what it means for an individual to put their careers on the line in these organizations and then being trapped into these dynamics and the effect of that at the psychological level for other people. And I know we, you know, this is a hot topic for me, but we have all these newer trends of like psychological safety and all these things that sound fantastic to implement in the organization, but they don't get to the root of the issue. We cannot talk about psychological safety without talking about abuse, in my view. Right? We can't really put psychological safety in the hands of these narcissistic leaders who by trade lack empathy. They don't have the capacity to connect with people. They don't have the capacity to walk in other people's shoes, to create a safe environment. And even if they fake it because they're really good at it, what we're doing is harming those who are potential targets to expose themselves, their vulnerabilities, their stories, their truths in an environment in which that can be used against them naturally. And so, but we don't have the education at the institutional level. We also don't have the courage to sit down and bring people that understands these at a deeper level to educate us so that we can have practices and norms and really a change of paradigm as to what are we considering good leadership versus not, and how we're all humans at the end of the day. We bring some kind of mental disorder, some kind of trauma, some kind of something we're trying to resolve as a human being into the organization. Nobody is exempt of that. And we still treat organizations as machines, and we still treat organizations as if people are just commodities and objects. And so in itself, you know, a lot of the corporate cultures are very narcissistic by nature. And so it goes normalized and it goes under the rug, because who would want to change that if it's working for the profits? But I get off my soapbox with that. I just always, you know, have to bring that up, because when I see all the mainstream on like psychological safety and how we're going to solve the world's problems, the first thing I think about is we need to be very educated when we bring these strategies into the workplace, because we cannot just continue to put band-aids and lip service into these conversations if we really want to see meaningful change happen.
Yeah, don't worry about jumping on your soapbox, because we love it. Because it also brings up a good point where when we do a lot of trainings on abuse specifically, one of the points that we bring up is that in order for someone to go through with perpetrating abuse against somebody else or perpetrating violence against somebody else, they have to believe that person is less than them. If they are viewing that person then as an object, they are inherently viewing them as less than. I'm not going to treat my Xbox as an equal to myself, because that to me is an object. I'm using that thing to get something out of it. So when you have employers or businesses who are inherently just viewing the people there working for them as cogs in a machine, as a means to an end, they're not going to be able to even recognize that they are being abusive or harmful to their employees, because they're not seeing them as equals or as individuals. They're seeing them as just objects to use. So I appreciate
there's no way to argue with that. I mean, it's there. We're really scratching the surface with all of these. This could be like a 5-part series on the issue, but that is the elemental dysfunction. You know, like we lost the capacity to see each other's humanity, and we have given too much leeway. You know, and I don't see a much dramatic difference between abuse at home and abuse in the workplace at all. I just think the parallels are just so, you know, incredible. And I mean, if you have somebody abusing his spouse at home, is likely abusing everybody in the workplace. Like, it's not, that person is not a different person. We are bringing those dynamics from outside into the organization. Organizations are misunderstanding it and they're compartmentalizing them, not digging into, not considering that we are a subset of society. We are a microcosm of society in these organizations, and that these things happen. And the more we want to brush them under the rug and not sit down and have the conversations that need to happen to fix the issue to begin with, to choose the right people, to address the behaviors that, you know, create toxicity. Like nowadays, everything is a toxic workplace, right? Well, let's address what creates the toxicity. Let's not like try to make it look glamorous. Let's just go down to what's the pathology that's underneath it, because it just doesn't happen, right? And we cannot request empathy as if it is something that magically happens. Like, in order for you to have an empathetic environment, you have to have people that have capacity to empathize. You have to have people that have capacity to change, to mature, to internalize their own reckoning and use it to become better people and better attuned with the issues that affect other people. In my personal view, and I want to make a disclaimer, this is Lindsay's point of view, you know, we need to become more critical and more educated as to who, as to how we understand this taking place, and who do we grant the privilege to be in a position of power that impacts so many other lives, and not do it in such a random way with outdated paradigms and models and leadership philosophies that don't serve humanity anymore.
Well, and that's a big part of the conundrum, right? Because when an organization is looking at who do they want as a leader, they want somebody who's driving those profit margins. They want somebody who's, you know, expanding the business or getting more clients or getting more customers or whatever it is that's going on in the business, because the corporation is looking at bottom line. But when we have to look at the fact that every single person that works in this organization is a human being, then that's a different kind of leadership style that we need to aim for. And so how do you get the corporation, the organization who's just aiming toward profits, to switch their mindset to say, hey, we need to take care of all of the human beings that we are surrounded with every day? Because in the end, what is our profit margin if every single employee that works here is suffering abuse.
And what is the point of being profitable if at the end of the day we're also need somebody that has the cold blood to lay off thousands of people in droves in order to keep the status of that profitable margin? Again, it could go, this could go for hours, but they need those people in those positions for sure. But it's not that they need those people, it's that we need to change the way in which we think about an organization. Because I don't believe that being successful and ambitious and profitable and trying to strive to be excellent and the best is mutually exclusive of being a good human being, having, you know, creating a space for that ambition to grow in a healthy way, for us to be able to approach those goals and those margins and those big dreams that organizations have, you know, from a place of support from each other, of community, of, you know, addressing the problems head on, of healthy conflict. Like, there are dynamics that are more conducive even to being successful than the dynamics that create the illusion of success, but on you know, behind the curtain are very rotten and very damaged at the core. And so many people leave with so many scars, right? And these people go from we cross-pollinate from organization to organization. So it's not that it happened in this one place and it stayed there. Now we are propagating, right? The fears, the trauma, the everything across everywhere in our lives. And so it does not serve us as a society, I don't think.
It's always so like baffling to me that an organization would want to like lay off a bunch of people or would want to make sure that or continue to allow their workplace to be an unhealthy place for their employees to come to, when it just feels like it should be easy to understand that if your employees are happy to be at work, enjoy being at work, and they're not being abused, they're all going to work better. Which, if just from the baseline, your objective is to make as much money as possible and be profitable, if all your employees want to be there and they're not having to worry about experiencing abuse, which is going to hurt their overall like work ethic, you're going to see
overall reputation.
Yeah, your profits are going to go up. Your reputation is going to look better. More skilled employees are going to want to work for you. Yet it doesn't change.
Yeah. Because there is, a chasm between those who want to maintain control and status quo and those of us who are, you know, in small platforms and big platforms, you know, wanting a change, wanting to bring things back to basic humanity and basic dignity. And I mean, that is everything that those people with those dark personalities don't want, because then they become irrelevant and they have to fear face their biggest fears, which is, you know, recognizing that they're not all of that they think they are, that, you know. And so, and I do think it's that basic, but because we don't have the infrastructures to navigate these issues, we over-engineer them. And then, you know, organizations are overly concerned with liabilities and lawsuits and protecting the abusive stuff because it may look back on the press on us. When you know, it should be as easy as and I don't know what your experience is with victims of domestic violence, but I imagine it's similar. These people just want to be treated right. They just want to be freed up from the trap of being in a circumstance that is, you know, detrimental to their health. They just want to be given the opportunity to thrive, have the same shot everybody else to be successful in life. I don't know anybody that has any traumatic experience that wants to live with that forever. Most of us who have gone through this stuff want to heal and want to grow, want to forget about that, put it behind. None of us is thinking, oh, I'm going to wait to be abused and I'm going to sit here because then I can sue the company. Nobody's doing that.
Yeah.
And I just think it's such a silly situation when you look at it from that perspective that could be resolved in such a quick manner if we had the right people, the right perspectives, and the decency to take in this issue and accept that and say, yeah, this stuff happens. It's normal that it happens. And how do we prevent ourselves from falling into that direction so that we can have a thriving organization instead? I don't know if that's overly simplistic, but for me, it's as simple as that.
It seems simple enough, at least.
Yeah.
So, Lindsay, looking at then, okay, we talked about how some of this can pop up into the workplace. So let's say I'm working at a workplace and I might recognize some of these things are present. Some of those unhealthy or narcissistic tendencies are there. What steps can I take then, or could the other employees also take, to kind of address these issues?
The addressing part is a tricky situation, but I have a couple of thoughts for people to consider, right? Because, I mean, it really depends on where you are. Some people feel more equipped to go straight on and address it and call it out and file a complaint and, you know, in the most pervasive cases, becoming a whistleblower and take the weight that comes with that, right? They're depending on the scale of the issue and the abuse and the situation there, the repercussions are more or less. And some people are ready to do that and have build the strength to go through the scary parts of it and move forward. And some people are still digesting what is going on and, you know, how does that affect me and my paycheck and the food that I can put at the table, right? But I think first and foremost, if anything, before it happens, or if you think it's happening to you in the workplace, go to your computer or to your phone and start Googling these topics. What I'm sharing here is not my original ideas. These are ideas that are out there for years. It's been probably 10 or 12 years that I came across the first time. And I'm sure many decades before, there are people who have been trying to call attention to these issues, right? So let's do our part in being educated, understanding the basics, understanding what it is, how it presents itself, recognizing whether or not you have been a target of it, right? And start putting some language around what you would need to say if you get to the point where you have to escalate an issue or where you have to make a decision to walk away from the issue. So to me, that's the fundamental part anybody can do. And you don't have to wait until it happens to you. Then if you are in the situation, we need to be mindful that sometimes our institutions are not prepared to deal with these type of complaints in a formal way, right? There are laws, there are policies, there are, you know, parameters, whether we agree with them or not, that establish what is the code of conduct of an organization and what they consider wrong and what they consider right, which you don't have to agree with because they're not perfect, okay? But if you are going to use the mechanisms within the organization to attempt to address it, to attempt to find a fair, you know, shot at resolving an issue like that, one of the basic strategies you always need to have is documentation. These are not issues that you can just bring up anecdotally. You need to start writing down emails. You need to avoid conversations behind doors with no witnesses. You have to make sure that you have a recollection of things that could indicate, right, that you've been a part of an abusive cycle or an abusive situation at work. And always, always, always communicate in writing, if it is with HR, with ethics and compliance, whatever it is that the unit within your organization that addresses the complaint, it always has to be in writing. That's another basic. And ultimately, you know, and this is not a recommendation or anything, but I do think that we ourselves need to start preparing better to identify and settle on what is our standard to consider somebody a healthy leader, right? So we can set some boundaries so that we can say, well, you may have a title and I may report to you, but that does not make you my leader. That does not make you the person that I'm going to accept authority from. So that we can have a place to start from in identifying whether or not the situation I'm in is acceptable for myself. So those three things.
Yeah, and those all seem like relatively like easy steps for people to take, right? Like, there's nothing wrong with having knowledge available to you, even if you never need that knowledge. Like, if I'm Googling and looking up information on a narcissistic or an abusive workplace, that doesn't necessarily I might ever need that information, but at least now I'm prepared for it when like some of those things start popping up. Like, oh yep, I know that these things are not good, not things that I want in the not in my workplace. So I can recognize it earlier into that situation before it gets to the point where like I feel really stuck and trapped, right? It's the same reason we do presentations on domestic violence and talk about red flags or warning signs, to give people that opportunity to recognize the early red flags before they now feel stuck in that relationship.
Can I say one more thing?
Yeah.
Because it's really important what you just said. And it may also be that you might never be a target directly, but it could be that somebody around you would be.
Yeah.
Who doesn't know, right? So we started talking, you started mentioning things about bystanding and enablers and this kind of stuff. And if I'm not in these kind of dynamics, if you're not a target, you're an enabler, either by active enabling or by omission, right? And so it's important to know too that in an organizational environment, you're a part of an ecosystem, you're a part of a team, you're a part of a group of people that are supposed to support each other to achieve an objective, right? And when these type of dynamics get in the way of that, typically what happens is that the targeted individuals become ostracized and isolated, and they don't have anybody to talk to. They don't have anybody to go to. They don't have a frame of reference. And it may be that you would be in those situations where you could be a resource, where you could be somebody that educates another person, where you could be a sounding board of somebody who's trying to navigate those issues that are really, really complicated to navigate.
And I always appreciate when I'm listening to like one of our guests talking, and I'm like, oh, easy connection to the work that we're doing already in DVSA. Because when I work with men specifically, I will mention and talk to them as like, if you're in a friend group and you have one friend who tells a sexist joke or like something along those lines, and you laugh or go along with it, yes, maybe you will never harm somebody, but how do you know your friend won't? Because your friend now believes that everyone in that circle has the same viewpoints as they do. So if we are trying to create environments where people aren't being harmed, being quiet isn't helpful. Being quiet just makes us complicit in the harm that's happening, because we are not willing to step in and call it out, or we are so afraid of what could happen to us that we are not willing to take that step to make sure that we are looking out for the other employees that we're working with.
Simon Sinek is one of my favorite people in the whole world, and as I'm sure is everybody's is. But he says things that for me are like so elemental and at the same time don't seem to resonate broadly. But he has this philosophy of be the leader you wish you had, and what it is to look up for the people on the right side of you and the people on the left side of you, and be that person that is there to elevate your team and to support your team. And I think it applies to domestic violence, and I think it applies to abuse in the workplace, and it applies to every other, it applies to inclusion. We have to be those people if we don't find them, right? And the education that we can have and the awareness that we can have, even if we're not victims of receiving the treatment, can make us very instrumental in creating change wherever we are.
So, Lindsay, then as a final question for you, and maybe this one ends up as a whole episode in and of itself, but if I am recognizing that maybe myself, I'm not being the one who is abused by my employer, but I recognize that someone else in my workplace is experiencing that, how do I overcome that fear of possible retaliation, that fear of possibly having this person who's abusive now directing that towards me? How can I take those steps to make sure that I'm helping my other employees and not just being complicit in the abuse that they're experiencing?
I don't know if this is the answer that you're looking for from me, but I do think making the choice, making the steps to taking on such a big undertake requires a lot of personal integrity. It requires your own moral compass at play. What are you willing to be a part of? What are you willing to enable? What are you willing to observe and do nothing about? And whether or not you can go to bed with that. There will be some kind of retaliation. I don't know that there's any formula to avoid that. Is either going to come from a formal way of retaliate against you, where the organization may, their immune system may activate, right? And because you were the one who spoke up, right? Everything may become undesirable to you anymore and you decide to leave. It may be that you are in the right place at the right time, and what you do is a heroic action that ignites a deeper, more profound change in your ecosystem, and you took the first step. But there's no guarantees, right? I think it all comes from you. What are your values? What is your integrity? Where's your line? What are you willing to observe and say nothing about? How do you feel? How would you feel at the end of the day, going home alone, looking at yourself in the mirror, and remembering you sat there, you witnessed it, you knew what was going on, you said nothing, and can you leave with yourself with that decision? But it is a very, very personal choice, and it's a very personal risk. And the only thing I know is that if more of us were willing to take the risk, the issue would start to disappear quicker. Because it's not the same that one person comes forward with their lived experience as many people coming forward with creating a newer sense of reality and really speaking about situations that are happening that are not okay, and that it's okay to say that it's not okay and demand better conditions to do what you're there to do.
Yeah. And I know some people listening might end up with the idea of, well, I rely far too much on my paycheck to be able to take that risk, which is completely understandable. Providing for ourselves and families always comes first. And if you're in that position where you reporting this ends up where you're fearful of the retaliation, where you would lose your job, obviously, please do not put yourself in a position where you're going to harm yourself trying to help others. But if you do feel like you're in a position where if I lose my job, I can find another one, or if I'm good for a while, like I'll be okay if something bad happens to me, or like I'll be able to handle it, you're in the perfect position to be able to help those who might not be able to say anything. And we also know that when one person decides to step up and say something, like you said, Lindsay, more people are going to be willing to step up and say those things as well. Because now they're seeing that the person who has made them so fearful isn't invincible. There are people who are willing to take them down, and there's power in numbers.
I agree. I mean, like I said, it's a really personal decision. You have to reckon with yourself, and at the end, they know what you can live with and where you are in that situation. What are your likelihood of taking a step forward and assume, you know, that you did the right thing without expecting outcomes. I mean, it's a complicated place to be. I personally, and I'm not speaking from a place of, you know, theories. I've been in the situation where I've taken the heat for it. I've had to quit jobs because I was outspoken about things. And I've had other experiences where speaking up was absolutely, you know, amazing. And it created the change that we were looking for. And so, but you never know where the curveball is going to come from. It's a matter of what's important to you, what role you want to play. You know, I my school of thought is the field of organization development. And the fundamental principle of being in that field is that you as an individual, as a leader, are an instrument of change. And so how are you going to use yourself to create change? And are you equipped to take a step forward?
Well, thank you for joining us today, Lindsay. I've genuinely enjoyed this conversation, as I am sure our listeners have as well. But before we wrap up here, is there anything else you want to let our audience know?
I want to leave, you know, everybody with this message. And hopefully it continues to add into our way to reflect about, you know, our decisions and the role we want to play. But something to always keep in mind is that the human validation that comes from being seen and heard and advocated for is probably the highest purpose we have as leaders. Inside the organization, outside the organization, that is a really true signature of what it is to be a leader. That's why we tap into those roles. So I want to acknowledge the courage of people who have gone through these and other types of abuse that come forward and become force multipliers and genuinely an inspiration for people like me to also come forward with my testimony and my message, especially when these individuals have been trapped into institutional betrayal. And more than anything, the message is also to people with the power within the institutions to create change, to make things happen, and to really design infrastructures that are geared for safety, morals, ethics, and that we stop. My dream will be that we stop comparing narcissistic traits with what it is to be a leader, because narcissism is not leadership. They're two very different categories of traits that we are blending way too much and is creating just a lot of damage.
Well, thank you for that, Lindsay. And before we sign out then, is there any socials that you would like to push out to our audience?
I'm only on LinkedIn. I don't have a business. I don't do anything to promote myself with this particular topic. But if anybody needs some level of guidance or a listening ear or a little bit of perspective, they can find me on LinkedIn. Lindsay Ruiz, LindsayRuiz.
Awesome. I'll make sure I link that in the show notes as well, if anybody does want to check you out on LinkedIn. And maybe we'll have to have you come back to do an episode discussing what makes a good leader.
Anytime.
Awesome. Well, thank you again, Lindsay, and thank you all for listening today. Please follow us on Facebook, Instagram, X, and TikTok at Touchy Subs Pod to keep up to date when we have new content coming out as well as new episodes. Please email us any questions, comments, or concerns to touchysubjectspodcast@gmail.com. And please rate and follow us on your favorite podcast listening app. It really does help the show out.
And in the meantime, don't be afraid to challenge, ask, and discuss when it comes to touchy subjects.